address and understand Indigenous laws and to walk together as we best we can on pathways to reconciliation. So I want to thank Professor Lindsay Burrows, who organized that fantastic camp, and I hope that all of us at some point get to experience that. This long history of Indigenous laws and governance is important to keep in mind as we reflect here today on the 150th anniversary of the Supreme Court of Canada. And that invites us to reflect not only on history, but on the values that sustain our institutions. The long and difficult path to reconciliation with Indigenous peoples is there, of course, but even in this process, Canada still has much to be grateful for. Unlike so many jurisdictions, the appointment and decision-making processes of our Supreme Court have remained relatively free from the corrosive pull of partisan politics. Our court has held fast to its central purpose to uphold the rule of law with independence, impartiality, and fairness. And this is no small achievement, and it is a legacy for which generations of Canadians are and should be thankful. But gratitude can't give way to complacency. Around the world, we are witnessing courts under pressure, their independence questioned, their authority undermined. The rising tide of misinformation and polarization is like a flood, not me, a different flood, pressing against the foundations of democracy. And if we don't reinforce those foundations, the water will find its way into those cracks. And so that's why the work of protecting the rule of law and judicial independence is not just an anniversary celebration, it's a daily duty. We must fight tooth and nail to preserve public trust, to strengthen access to justice, and to ensure that the law remains a shield for all and not a weapon for the few. So on that note, it is a great honour to welcome and introduce the Supreme Court of Canada Justice, the Honourable Malcolm Rowe, back to Queen's Law today. Justice Rowe embodies our need to have confidence in our highest court and the justice system more broadly. He is an outstanding jurist and deeply committed to the rule of law. At the time when he was being considered for appointment, he responded to a question of why he wanted to be a Supreme Court judge and said, this is a rough quote, "Why do you want to do that?" was the question. There have been so many outstanding jurists who have been on the Supreme Court. Wilson, Dixon, Laskin, Lemire, and it goes on and on and on. Justin Sapinka, he was my favorite. We could debate that. And it just goes on and on and on. How can I possibly present myself to sit in the place where these people have sat? And I finally said to myself, my country has been darn good to me, and if I can do something for my country, then I want to do it. And I think that underscores both his humility and his dedication to service. Justice Rowe's early career pivoted between public and private sectors, and he emerged as an expert in international law, including the negotiation of a new UN Convention on the High Sea Fisheries. He was appointed to the Newfoundland and Labrador Supreme Court Trial Division in 1999 and elevated to the Court of Appeal in 2001. And his appointment to the Supreme Court in 2016 made him the first justice appointed from the beautiful and proud province of Newfoundland and Labrador. His appointment to the Supreme Court was, in a way, a sad thing for us because it was to replace Thomas Cromwell, who is a proud graduate of Queen's Law. So we cannot claim Justice Rowe as one of our own, but we feel he has an affinity with this beautiful place and with these waters in particular, and we hope that we will bring him back time and time again. So following Justice Rowe's presentation, we will have brief reflections from two outstanding Queen's Law professors, Lisa Kerr, Professor Lisa Kerr, who is one of the world's leading scholars in criminal law, and Professor Jacob Weinrib, one of the world's leading scholars in public law. And then we'll have a little time for Q&A. So please join me in welcoming Justice Rowe.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction, Dean Flood. Je suis honoré d'avoir été invité à prononcer quelques mots à l'occasion du 150e anniversaire de la Cour suprême du Canada. C'est toujours un plaisir de rendre visite à la faculté de droit de l'Université Queen's. In the view of medieval, Renaissance, and Enlightenment scholars, the works of ancient writers like Aristotle, or Cicero, or St. Augustine were revered. The old was estimable, while the contemporary, in their view, fell short. The reverse is true as to how the Supreme Court of Canada is seen today. The old is considered of little worth, while the contemporary is celebrated as a type of golden age. Commentary on the Supreme Court, indeed the whole legal system, before 1982, tends to be perhaps dismissive. The titles tell the story. And here is the title of a major work, a book on the history of the Supreme Court, quote, The Captive Court, A Study of the Supreme Court of Canada, end of quote. Not exactly flattering. And then another one, by a major author, From Subservient Officers of the Crown to Independent Servants of the People. That's another leading work. Post 1982, the court and the legal system in general is seen as entering a golden age. In a book entitled Canada in the World, Comparative Perspectives on the Canadian Constitution, Rand Herschel of the University of Toronto described the transformation of the Supreme Court post-1982. Well, what happened in 1982 was the Constitution Act 1982, notably the Charter and constitutional protection for Aboriginal and treaty rights. Here's what Professor Herschel said. Canada entered the 20th century embodying the deferential British-style constitutional tradition, not exactly complimentary, and emerged out of it with a robust constitutional culture featuring active judicial review, an acclaimed constitutional Bill of Rights, and pervasive rights discourse, and one of the most frequently cited high courts in the world, end of quote. There is something to that, by the way. I gave a lecture recently to the Trudeau Foundation on the Charter in the international context. And it is fair to say that the Charter is both the product of a long tradition of political and civil rights embodied after the Second World War in a series of particularly three instruments, which were, this is what happens, you go off text, three instruments which were of great significance. The first one, 1948, the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. 1950, the European Convention on Human Rights. And 1966, the Universal Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. If you happen to read Barry Strayer's book, The Charter Revolution, it's set out in some detail. Strayer was one of the principal drafters of the Constitution Act 1982, especially the Charter, and he describes the process whereby these sources of rights, these statements of rights that were institutionalized and adopted very widely internationally in the post-World War II period, were reflected in the Charter. There are some aspects of the Charter which are unique to Canada, notably things relating to official language rights and education. But when you look at things like the civil and political rights, the legal rights relating to search and seizure and the like, and equality rights, they are in very large measure a reflection, another statement in the Canadian context of what was set out in a sort of a post-World War II liberal consensus, particularly as reflected in those three instruments. And one of the things that I want to emphasize, because we're talking about the first 150 years of the court, is that we should not fall into the trap of what is sometimes called historical presentism, which is to evaluate the actions of those 150 years ago, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, by reference, as if those actions were being taken today. You always live in contemporary society. And while we consider ourselves to be very advanced and very progressive and doing exactly the right thing, in 50 years' time, I guarantee you, people will look back and say, how could they, you know, how could they express themselves in that way 50 years ago? One always has to put things in a historical context. That's very important, particularly when you're looking at the history of an institution such as the Supreme Court. Now, it is true that the beginnings of the court were somewhat inauspicious. The court was contemplated at the time of Confederation in 1867, but it was not established. It was only established in 1875. And why did it take 8 years? And one of the reasons, one of the principal reasons it took 8 years was because there was a lot of pushing and shoving and to-ing and fro-ing as to whether there would be a Supreme Court. The motivating factor was the concern by the provinces that the federal government, which had been granted the authority under the British North America Act, now the Constitution Act 1867, the power of appointment of judges would be used so as to put in place judges that favored the national government, that favored the Parliament of Canada, and because, in a sense, the division of powers is a zero-sum game, to the extent that the Parliament of Canada, their authority, their competence is greater, correspondingly that of the provinces and the provincial legislatures is diminished. So anyway, the third attempt in 1875 was successful, and it was the establishment of the court. There were then six judges, but they were sort of part-time in a way, and because they also served as judges of the Exchequer Court. The Exchequer Court no longer exists, but it's been succeeded by the Federal Court of Canada, so which deals with federal administrative matters and claims against the Crown and the like. So the six judges, sort of day one, they did Exchequer Court stuff, day two, they did Supreme Court stuff, but that was finally sorted out in 1887 when the Exchequer Court was established on its own and with a separate bench. So by 1887, being a member of the Supreme Court of Canada was no longer more or less a part-time job, it became a full-time job. Appeals to the Supreme Court were mainly from decisions of the courts of appeal in the provinces. Up until 1949, the final court of appeal, the ultimate decision maker, was not the Supreme Court of Canada, notwithstanding its name, but rather was the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council. What the heck is that? Well, if you've taken your law courses, you'll know the JCPC used to be the House of Lords, the law lords with their hats spun around to deal with matters of the empire as opposed to the United Kingdom. And of course, the JCPC still exists and is the final court of appeal of some countries like Trinidad and Tobago. But it ceased to be the final court of appeal for Canada in 1949. However, one has to bear in mind is that while the JCPC, the Privy Council, was the final court of appeal, in fact, relatively few cases went to London. Most cases, the end of the line was the Supreme Court of Canada. Although, when you open up your case books in constitutional law, you will find from the period up until 1949, more cases from the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council than you will find from the Supreme Court of Canada, because on the really big cases, notably the division of powers, federal versus provincial authority, oftentimes the decision was a decision of the JCPC. Now, one of the, and so what was it that the Supreme Court did most of the time? Well, it did what the courts of appeal did. And the courts of appeal did what trial courts did, mainly criminal matters and civil matters like contract claims or negligence claims. And to the extent that there were public law issues that went to the court, very often they related to regulatory matters, what we'd think of now in terms of administrative law. But at that period, the real sort of hot action when it came to regulatory matters was railroads. Not exactly as hot a topic these days, but it was big stuff in those days. So that was what the judges of the Supreme Court were doing during most of the first 100 years of the court's existence. Now, the conduct of the judges in this earlier period was much criticized for several reasons. One was the willingness of Supreme Court judges to undertake public inquiries. This doesn't occur anymore, but what happens now is sometimes governments will choose a retired judge, like John Major. He did the Air India inquiry, but after he had retired. But let me give you one example of a justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, who in the early 1960s participated in a public inquiry while a member of the Supreme Court of Canada. It was Justice Emmett Hall, and Royal Commission in which he participated led to Medicare. So they weren't involved in small matters. Sometimes they were involved in very substantial matters. A second point of criticism was that the judges had pretty good friendships with politicians, and many of them were themselves former politicians. And I'll refer, as I go through, to several of the leading jurists who were former politicians. This is not something, I mean, I know a few politicians, some of them are friends, but, you know, one has to be very careful these days about one's P's and Q's, shall we say. Not quite the same way. They probably went over to the Rideau Club and had a few drinks at the end of the day, which we don't do anymore. With ministers, or actually anybody else, as far as that goes. But one of the things I'd emphasize is that while it doesn't sort of sit well with us today to have that close personal relationship between judges and serving politicians, I have not, in my reading about the history of the court and some of the biographies of the leading judges, ever seen an instance where there was a shadow of doubt that the court engaged improperly in discussions with sitting politicians, serving politicians, which influenced their decisions. So I don't get too excited about that. A third point, which I think is a very important point, something which does warrant, it's a deeper point, was that for many, many years, the Supreme Court of Canada took an approach to statutory interpretation, and to some extent to the interpretation of the one really leading constitutional document at the time, the Constitution Act 1867, in an approach that was referred to as formalism. It very, very much focused on the text, the exact wording. It looked at grammatical considerations, and it was and the rules of grammar and the like. And it did not take a wider view of these matters, either in terms of the interpretation of statutes, which today is the mantra is text, context, and purpose. You cannot lose sight of text. You can't escape that. But the text is given its meaning from the context in which it is used and the purpose for which it is included in the legislation. So it's a different approach. It isn't a narrow, grammatical, dictionary-based approach that was. But what you have to remember about the Supreme Court of Canada is that every other common law court was doing exactly the same thing. And so if one says, well, isn't that disappointing? Well, then you have to say it about the courts of in every other jurisdiction. And thus, I come back to the idea that we shouldn't judge the actions of jurists 100 years ago or 80 years ago by reference to the contemporary situation. I'm not making... So I should motor along here. What I would say is that there's a lot of criticism of the jurisprudence of the court relating to the federal-provincial division of powers in this early period. It's actually quite misplaced, because the Supreme Court of Canada, in its decisions in terms of the powers of the federal parliament versus provincial legislatures, did in fact tend to tilt toward the center, towards a greater role for parliament. It was the Judicial Committee, the Privy Council, which tilted in favor of the provinces. And of course, the bête noire of this period was were several of the law lords. And so the division of powers was shaped by the JCPC, principally by opening up property and civil rights as one of the heads of powers of the provinces, and constraining trade and commerce, which is one of the federal powers. Viscount Haldane is the bête noire in all this. I'm going to just refer very quickly to two pre-1949 constitutional cases that I think show what I think even when you take the historical context into account, a very disappointing decision by the Supreme Court, and another one which was actually a very inspiring decision. And the very disappointing decision was the Persons case. And it related to whether women were eligible for appointment to the Senate. And so it was a textual phrase in Section 24, the Constitution Act 1867. Supreme Court of Canada said, no, as it was understood, persons meant men. And then it went to the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, and Viscount Sankey, who was a former Labour politician, reversed that and said, "Man, it's 1930, right?" and used the now famous metaphor that the Constitution is a living tree, capable of growth and development within its natural limits. So that is the disappointment I think one can point to. By contrast, what was really, I think, quite elevating in the jurisprudence of this earlier period was a 1938 decision, Reference re the Accurate News and Information Act. This was an Alberta statute which did a variety of things, but among them, it empowered a regulatory agency to order newspapers to print, quote, clarifications, end of quote, of stories considered to be inaccurate. And so maybe there's a little bit of an echo of that these days. Sir Lyman Poor Duff, the Chief Justice, a little bit of a dour man, but any a doer, I suppose, is proper pronunciation. This is what he wrote. The Constitution of Canada is to be similar in principle to that of the United Kingdom. In other words, a quote from the preamble of the 1867 instrument. It contemplates a parliament working under the influence of public opinion and public discussion. Such institutions derive their efficacy from the free discussion of affairs, from attack upon policy and administration and its defense, from the freest and fullest analysis and examination from every point of view of political proposals. I'm continuing with the quotation. Any attempt to abrogate this right of public debate and to suppress the traditional forms of the exercise of the right in terms of public meetings or the press, we didn't have much broadcasting at the time, is incompetent, or is beyond the jurisdiction of the legislatures of the province, and repugnant to the provisions of the Constitution Act 1867. The legislation manifestly places in the hands of provincial governments, or the Alberta government, autocratic powers which could be employed to frustrate in Alberta these rights of the people of Canada as a whole. End of quote. And in my view, from the pre-1949 period, this may have been the Supreme Court's finest hour. I'll deal very quickly with the Supreme Court from 1949 to 1982. This again was, at this point, the JCPC is gone. After 1949, it's the Supreme Court of Canada which has the final say within the judicial pyramid. And there are three decisions from this period which continue to stand out, and which I trust, if you've taken constitutional law, you will have studied these decisions. And if you're going to take constitutional law, I hope you will study these decisions. Three of them came out of Quebec. Saumur and the City of Quebec, 1953. Switzman and Ebling, better known as the Padlock case, 1957. And Roncarelli and Duplessis, 1959. All three of these arose under the heavy hand of Premier Maurice Duplessis. And if you know your history, you'll know that was a pretty heavy hand. Opposition to Duplessis' obscurantist policies motivated a young Montreal lawyer to advocate for constitutional protection of civil liberties. That young lawyer, who formed this view in the 1950s, was Pierre Elliott Trudeau. One of the judges who was really the most highly regarded of them was, of course, Justice Ivan Rand, who had been a former politician, right? Just because you're a politician doesn't mean you can't be a good jurist. I was never a politician, but I don't have a closed mind on these things. And he was a law professor, and he was a diplomat. Unfortunately, as his biographer Robert Kaplan described him, he was someone with a first-rate mind and a third-rate temperament. He was apparently a bit cranky. But he was an elegant and powerful writer. I won't quote from those cases, but they're very much a parallel to what Lyman Poor Duff had written in the 1938 case, which I quoted from before. It's really quite elevated, Rand's writing. And Kellogg, Justice Roy Kellogg and Doug Abbott, these were the three leading jurists of that period. The 1960s and the Canadian Bill of Rights. you know, if sort of fumble number one was the person's case, fumble number two, an even bigger one in a sense, was the Canadian Bill of Rights. In 1960, Parliament adopted, during the Diefenbaker administration, the Canadian Bill of Rights. It had a couple of weaknesses. One, it was a statute. It wasn't a constitutional instrument. And second, it only related to the federal matters within federal authority, not with provincial authority. Quite a different beast, quite a different type of legal instrument from the Charter later on. I think there were lessons learned from the Bill of Rights. But I think it, you'd have to say that whatever its weaknesses were, the potential of the Canadian Bill of Rights was effectively destroyed by the Supreme Court of Canada. Here's what Peter Russell said. Peter Russell, who died, I guess, about a year ago, he was a political scientist, very insightful on the court matters. He wrote in The Political Role of the Supreme Court of Canada in its First Century, he wrote it in 1985, quote, "The Supreme Court of Canada responded reluctantly and unevenly to the challenge of the 1960 Bill of Rights. Most of the judges did not seem anxious to assume the strong political role, maybe we'd say policy, but anyway, political role entailed in enforcing the standards of a comprehensive Bill of Rights on the popular branches, i.e. the democratically elected branches of government." And then Peter Russell went on to compare this underwhelming, essentially interpretation and application of the Canadian Bill of Rights, contrasted that with the Warren Court in the United States of the same era, which had a much more expansive view of the American Bill of Rights. 1970s in the Laskin Court. Borah Laskin became Chief Justice in 1973. Laskin was a Harvard-trained legal academic, as, of course, was Trudeau. And one of the reasons, I think, that Prime Minister Trudeau, the elder, appointed Laskin was because of two things. One, that both of them viewed the protection of rights as being of great significance. I think Harvard had a lot of influence there. And the second one was both of them were what I would call arch-centralists. They really wanted to augment federal authority with the consequence of a certain diminution of provincial authority. For myself, I prefer a little more of a balanced approach. I'm a great fan of Bill Letterman, the first dean of Queen's Law. Here's what Justice Laskin, Chief Justice Laskin, wrote in 1975 at the 100th anniversary of the Supreme Court. He wrote it in an article called "The Role and Functions of Final Appellate Courts, the Supreme Court of Canada." I quote, and this is important because Laskin articulated a mandate for the court which it had essentially failed to articulate before. "The Supreme Court's main function is to oversee the development of the law in the courts in Canada, to give guidance in articulate reasons and direction to the provincial courts, i.e. the courts within the provinces, and the federal court, on issues of national concern or of common concern to several provinces." Now, why does this, what is the significance of this? Before this framing in 1975, at the 100th anniversary of the court, there was a sense that you dealt with individual cases. There was a just disposition according to law, precedent, and good legal methodology of the case. But there was not the emphasis on the development of the law in a more comprehensive and integrated way. And so Laskin was pivotal in reshaping the court as a court that not didn't, because we always speak through individual cases. But when you read our sometimes very lengthy reasons for decision, what you will see is very often the particular dispute is used as a vehicle in which to reframe the law, to integrate things which are a bit disparate, to develop the law in light of contemporary circumstances and the like. And so what Laskin did is place the court on that type of footing, which it can, and a role which it continues to play today. I shall skip a little bit. Avant de conclure sur la période pré-charte, je souhaite faire quelques points sur l'interaction entre les différentes traditions juridiques de droit privé à la Cour suprême. Comme vous le savez, au Canada, les relations de droit privé sont régies par le droit civil d'origine française et la common law d'origine anglaise. Le droit civil est surtout appliqué au Québec. Au début de son histoire, la Cour suprême cherchait à unifier le droit privé sous l'égide de la common law. Frankly, what the court was doing was taking the civil code and giving it a common law cast. Big no-no. La Cour n'hésitait pas à utiliser des notions de common law pour résoudre des questions relevant du droit civil. D'ailleurs, le Code civil du Bas-Canada, Lower Canada, l'ancêtre du Code civil du Québec, était interprété comme une loi ordinaire. Il n'est pas une loi ordinaire. Pourtant, il a une structure et logique unique. Very different methodology in civil law. Graduellement, la Cour a commencé à reconnaître la cité de droit civil et à le considérer comme un système distinct, common law. L'influence des juges, and here are the three judges who are greatest importance in terms of establishing the civil law as a distinct body of law, which is to be addressed with a distinct methodology that is integral to the nature of a civil code. Les juges Mignot, Pigeon et Betts. Ils sont cités comme ayant contribué à une reconnaissance et un engagement plus profond avec le droit civil. Au fur des années, la Cour a développé une approche comparative, a comparative approach between the two sources of law, which is valid, une approche comparative à la common law et au droit civil, où les différences sont soulignées afin de mieux comprendre chaque système. Il est dit que dans les années 1960 et 1970, le droit civil était finalement considéré comme un système autonome à part entière. So, it was well established that the Civil Code of Quebec is to be understood and interpreted with a distinct methodology in parallel and in no way to be mixed up with the common law, but in a comparative way, which is useful. I shall touch very briefly, because of reasons of time, on post-1982. And I've spent a bit more time on the earlier period, because the earlier period is not well understood. The later period since 1982 was far better understood. But I'm just going to quote a couple of really pivotal cases. And here Chief Justice Dixon really stands out as an enormously influential figure to this day. I think the single most, I say this being mindful of having sat with Beverly McLaughlin, who was pretty impressive, and Antonio Lemaire, etc. But Dixon is, in my view, because he was there at the foundation, he was such an important figure, so wise as well, that his jurisprudence has endured and remains foundational for our constitutional analysis. In Hunter and Southam, 1984, 2 years after the Charter was adopted, he wrote, "The Constitution of Canada which includes the Charter, is the supreme law of Canada. Any law inconsistent with the provisions of the Constitution is, to the extent of that inconsistency, of no force and effect. That's 52-1. It goes on. The judiciary is the guardian of the Constitution. There's where the phrase comes from, Southern, and the pen of Chief Justice Dixon. The judiciary is the guardian of the Constitution, and the Charter, which is intended to constrain governmental action inconsistent with its rights and freedoms. The task of expounding a constitution is crucially different from that of construing a statute. Remember, I referred to formalism before. Very textual, very grammatically oriented. You know, look it up in the dictionary, there's the meaning. No, it's of a different nature. And while text, context, and purpose is how statutes, that's the framing of how statutory provisions are to be interpreted, the guidance, which was not given in Southam, which was given a couple of years later in Big M Drug Mart, that's where Chief Justice Dixon, again, set out the purposive approach to charter interpretation, which continues to be cited. I looked it up a while ago. I think it's been cited by the Supreme Court of Canada 300 times, Big M Drug Mart. To go back to what Chief Justice Dixon said, a statute defines present rights and obligations. It is easily enacted and as easily repealed or amended. A constitution, by contrast, is drafted with an eye to the future. Its function is to provide a continuing framework for the legitimate exercise of governmental power, and when joined by a Charter of Rights, for the unremitting protection of individual rights and liberties. This is pretty inspiring stuff. What I would say is that when you take the purpose of approach and the methodology that underlies it, set out in Big M Drug Mart a couple of years later after Southam, and you put it together with Viscount Sankey's, admittedly the metaphor of the living tree, what you find is a particular Canadian version of a living document, but one which is nonetheless connected and anchored in the origins of the Charter. And I referred very briefly before to 1948, UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Second, 1950, a European Convention on Human Rights. 1966, Universal Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Two of those Canada ratified. Obviously, it didn't ratify the European Convention because we're not a European country. But those are the roots, those are the origins. And to some extent, you look to those origins, those sources, to ascertain the purpose of the Charter rights. But unlike this empty debate the Americans have, frankly, about originalism and the like, the living tree ensures, the living tree concept and framing ensures that those are not rights which are frozen in time. As of the point of enactment, an adoption of the Charter in 1982, but they always are to be given a contemporary, meaningful place in a changing and dynamic society, and they will continue to do so. If the law is static, the law fails in its functions. If the law becomes so unanchored from its sources, it ceases to fulfill its proper function because it's unpredictable and people can't rely upon it in ordering their affairs. There is a way, however, to combine these two, which gives a degree of certainty, but at the same time provides a dynamic, contemporary nature, particularly to constitutional rights. And this is why I emphasize the significance of both of these concepts, the purpose of approach set out in Big M, and the idea of the living tree both working together. I'll quote just one more, I think I'm over time. And I don't want to leave this out because this is very, very important. Aboriginal and treaty rights. It's interesting, someone said to me recently, put a question to me about, you know, how Aboriginal treaty rights were dealt with in the Charter, and I stopped them. I tried to do so politely. Aboriginal and treaty rights are not in the Charter. Aboriginal and treaty rights do not have their origin in the 1982 instrument. They're dealt with separately from the Charter, and they are protected in a separate part of the Constitution Act 1982. We always think of 35(1), that's the operative provision. So their origin comes from historical circumstances. The protection of those rights is accomplished by 35(1), and their nature, origin, and the manner in which they are given practical expression uses quite a distinct methodology from the Charter. Here's what, again, I come back to Chief Justice Dixon and Justice Laforet writing together in Sparrow in 1990. While British policy towards the native population was based on respect for their right to occupy their traditional lands, a proposition to which the Royal Proclamation of 1763 bears witness. Now, I'm afraid the British policy of respecting the right to occupy traditional lands was detracted from rather catastrophically after Confederation, but I digress. In any case, while British policy towards the native population bears this witness, there was from the outset never any doubt that sovereignty and legislative power, indeed the underlying title to such lands, vested in the Crown. For many years, the rights of the Indians, that was the phrasing was used at the time, indigenous peoples, to their lands were virtually ignored. This is an important statement to make. It's a recognition that we had gone off the right pathway. We'd made some very serious errors, a lot of serious tragic consequences. It took a number of judicial decisions, notably the Calder case, it's interesting. Calder was 1973. It wasn't a product of the Charter. It wasn't a product of that process which led up to the Charter negotiation. The ball had started to roll in 73 with Calder, which said, as Chief Justice Dixon and Justice Laforet said, prompted a reassessment. 35(1) represents the culmination of a long and difficult struggle in both the political forum and the courts for the constitutional recognition, and I would add protection, of Aboriginal rights. It is important to note that the provision applies to Indians, First Nations, the Inuit, and the Métis. 35(1) provides a solid constitutional base upon which subsequent negotiations, what we would call nation-to-nation dealings, can take place. It also affords Aboriginal peoples constitutional protections for their rights, end of quote. I would add, which constitutional protections, where necessary, can be vindicated before the courts. So those are a couple of quite foundational statements when you look at post-1982. So I'll come to the conclusion. I've cut out a few things. I'm quite optimistic when I look back at the service rendered by judges of the Supreme Court over the past century and a half. And I must say, even though Alan Dodek is a friend, I don't agree with him that the court had really failed to fulfill its function in the earlier years. Its function was simply conceived of differently. And on occasion, when when a great issue arose, sometimes they dropped the ball. The person's case, clearly so. The Canadian Bill of Rights, clearly so. But in the what were called the Common Law Bill of Rights cases in the 1950s, particularly in the writings of Ivan Rann, I think the court rose to the occasion. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. I guess I would say, just very briefly, looking out at all these young people, these just starting out on your careers, as well as a few of us who are a little bit further on, I would offer a brief quote from The Tempest by Shakespeare, Act 5, Scene 1. And so Prospero's daughter Miranda exclaims, "How beauteous mankind is, O brave new world that has such people in it." To which Prospero, her wise father, replies, "'Tis new to thee." Thereby the wise Prospero counseled kindly caution to his beloved daughter, whose lack of worldly experience perhaps led her to excessive optimism. As you embark on your legal careers, bear with you the optimism that befits your youth, but bear in mind Prospero's caution that this brave new world is new to thee. Thank you.
Well, first I want to thank Justice Roe for visiting us at Queens and for those very interesting remarks. It was delightful. I learned a lot. I'm sure we all did. One of the topics that I'm very interested in is how the role of interveners at the Supreme Court has changed over the historical period that Justice Roe outlined for us. So let me try to make a few comments about that evolution. So the conventional view, the sort of received wisdom, is that the Supreme Court of Canada is extremely open to non-party interveners, especially since 1982, and especially compared to apex courts in the rest of the common law world. And that conventional view is largely true, but I want to just see if I can add some nuance to it. But first, for those of you who started law school 2 weeks ago, what is an intervener? An intervener is a litigant who's not a party to the case, right? Not the Crown or the accused or the plaintiff or defendant. Not one of the actual litigants, but a third party. It could be, at the Supreme Court level, a particular level of government. It's often public interest organizations. So to take an example close to home, the Queen's Prison Law Clinic regularly applies to intervene at appellate courts. And we do that when criminal or administrative law cases raise issues that we think will affect the thousands of prisoners that the clinic represents, and where we think we might be able to assist the court with that perspective. So part of why the legal system allows interveners is a recognition that some cases have really significant and broad effects. It makes sense then that Canada saw a substantial increase in interveners after the constitutional changes of 1982. Charter cases especially don't impact only the immediate parties to the litigation. One example of a case where interveners were very important is the 2015 Carter case. This was the case about the criminal prohibition on medically assisted death. Every single one of us is affected by this ruling. For all of us, it changes the options we have at the end of life. Now, the court heard from many interveners in Carter. It heard from the medical associations grappling with the ethical issues that physicians would face if a change in the law came. It heard from disability and religious organizations who were opposed to a change in the law. It heard from civil liberties organizations who wanted more individual freedom and choice for those facing serious illness or death. So the idea is that interveners can help courts get to better outcomes by allowing specialized expert perspectives. And they can also enhance the legitimacy of decisions that have very broad effects by allowing broader participation. So what do I want to try to add to the picture? This view that Canada is comparatively open to interveners. I want to suggest that the Supreme Court has been simultaneously open to and wary of public interest interveners. The court does tend to be very liberal in granting leave to intervene. Many are allowed in. But the participatory rights of interveners have become increasingly constrained in recent years in terms of things like the page limit for factums, which went from 20 to 10, in terms of the time limit for oral argument, which went from 15 to 10 and then to 5. Then most recently, counsel for interveners are no longer physically allowed to appear in person inside the courtroom. What began as a rule to address public health concerns during the pandemic has morphed into a new status quo. And many in the bar have been very vocal about this. They think being stuck on Zoom diminishes the role of interveners considerably and that it limits their ability to make a meaningful impact. Now, I am not on a screen today, and I'm very grateful for that, but I do have the same 5-minute time limit that interveners have. So let me skip past all of the appropriate details and citations and go right to offering a few takeaways. I think the history of interveners at the Supreme Court of Canada is a history that unfolds in parallel to the mainstream story. That story is about the arrival of the Charter, about the expanded function of the Supreme Court, about the court's evolution from the historical court that Justice Roe described for us to a court that regularly decides issues of national public importance and the fundamental rights of Canadians. With all of the legitimacy gains and losses that can come from that expanded role, the full picture of the history of interveners fits neatly into that broader story. Interveners are often permitted at the Supreme Court, no doubt because of the breadth of impact of the court's decision and the need and value of expertise beyond the parties. But the features and mode of intervener participation has changed significantly in recent years. The court wants them to be included, it seems, but also limits their ability to make an impact. And those two impulses, inclusion alongside limitation, they might appear to be at odds with one another. This might look like an uneasy coexistence. But perhaps both are underwritten by the same kind of concern. Inclusion of broad perspective as a way to enhance the legitimacy of the court's far-reaching rulings. Limitation as a way to prevent the appearance of a court captured by special interests. Perhaps both have to be part of the court operating in the Charter era. So with that, I will hand the mic to my colleague Jacob Weinribs for some reflections.
So I want to thank Justice Roe for joining us today and for his illuminating remarks. Justice Roe, you had me at the greatness of Justice Ayn Rand, or as we refer to him in my constitutional law class, the GOAT. When the Charter of Rights and Freedoms was enacted, judges on the Supreme Court of Canada issued two reactions. First, they emphasized that while the Charter enhanced the power of the court, its enactment was not a judicial power grab. As Chief Justice Brian Dixon put at a luncheon in 1985, we did not ask for the enactment of the Charter. It was thrust upon us. And as Justice Wilson put the point, perhaps even more succinctly, we didn't volunteer. Second, the judges characterized the Charter as, in Dixon's words, the greatest challenge in the history of the Supreme Court of Canada. These days, the Charter is so familiar that we sometimes forget how transformative it is, but it created nothing less than a new kind of justice in Canada, what comparative constitutional lawyers refer to as constitutional justice. On this 150th anniversary of the Supreme Court of Canada, I want to set out the distinctiveness of this idea of justice. Prior to the enactment of the Charter, the central preoccupation of Canadian constitutional law was jurisdiction. Under the British North America Act, individuals could challenge legislation on the grounds that it transgressed the division of powers between the federal and provincial governments. But so long as federal and provincial legislatures operated within their jurisdiction, the dominant view, at least after Justice Rand retired in 1959, was that Federal and provincial legislatures were not constrained by rights, whether individual or collective. As Chief Justice Borelaskin once explained, prior to the Charter, the basic constitutional question was which jurisdiction, federal or provincial, should have the power to work the